Hello and welcome to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep, minute by minute, into the cinematic adaptation of Dune. I'm one of your hosts, John.
And I'm Zach.
And we're here, episode 2, season 2. I promise I'm going to stop doing the episode and everything. But I'm still excited because we're back, baby.
We are back. It's been so long since we recorded episode 1. It was nigh 5 minutes ago, John. And it still feels good to be back. All right, we are here to talk about minute 1 through 2 of Dune Part 2. This minute begins with an unceremonious cremation, and it ends with an exciting ceremonious award ceremony.
So many ceremonies.
Some on, some...
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, God. So, we ended yesterday's minute with the start of a sentence, the bat.
The bat.
And we start this minute with, to love Arrakis took everyone by surprise. There were no witnesses. The Harkonnen operation was perpetrated overnight without warning or declaration of war. And then we see a melting Atreides Eagle lapel logo, emblem, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Badge. Under the heat of these big ass flamethrowers just melt away.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed to know that the Atreides use like plastics and polyesters in their uniforms. That's I don't know. It seems like we should have moved past that, you know, 30,000 years into the future, or however long this is.
Stagnation, Zach.
Yeah.
Everything just stays the same.
I guess material sciences is not immune to a stagnation.
It's underfunded.
That's fair. Okay. It's like what happened with the Major League Baseball jerseys last season.
Oh, God. The stupid Fanatics ones that like were tearing and people were sweating through them all the time. For people that don't like baseball, this is just zone out now. But holy shit, those baseball jerseys were so trash.
Yeah,
and I think they're not on the Fanatics ones this year. I think they're back to Nike, but...
I would hope so. I mean, I only own like one like replica jersey.
I own one... officially licensed one, and yeah. Then everything else is bootleg as fuck.
Yeah, I'm glad I bought during the Nike era, because the people who bought during the Fanatics era were not happy about this.
No, and the players weren't even happy either. Like, no. So much so that the players association, like their union, was like, "Ayo, fuck these."
Ooh, that is the most sports we've ever talked on this podcast, John. I feel weird.
Baseball spring training is up right now, and I'm. Yeah. Gearing up for the season.
We are not usually sportsmen, but we do enjoy baseball.
Yeah.
So yeah, that the emblem on the Atreides uniform just melts away. And
it's probably a cheap tin or some shit. That just,
I don't know. Who knows? But this seems to be shortly after the events of the last movie.
Probably the morning after.
I said the day, or you know, maybe within the same couple of weeks. Well, it would have taken them a little bit of time to get all the bodies piled up. So, you know, I'm going to say a day or so, at least a day or so. They didn't just fall into piles right. Like that.
So let's think back to where we were in Dune Part 1. Paul and Jessica get thrown onto the ornithopter to be dropped off in the desert. That's the night of the attack. They go hang out in a Frem tent or a still tent.
For an unspecified amount of time.
Sure. I would like to think it's probably no more than 24 hours. It's probably just the rest of the... Well, I don't know, because it's still... It's like morning-ish when they're walking up...
Yeah, I think we see, you know, I'm kind of revising my statement. I think we see the passing of at least 2 or 3 days, because the fight with Jameis happens at evening, or is it daybreak?
No, it's day. So, okay. Frem tent, I would assume, or still tent, I would assume a day, because by the time they see what's going on in Arrakeen, it's morning. Ish.
Okay, so that's morning after.
Yeah. They're in the still tent. Then it's morning when Duncan, when they leave the still tent and when Duncan flies in the ornithopter.
Okay.
Paul disturbs Muad'Dib, who runs away.
Right. So that's day two.
Yeah. They spend that day at the Nexus, Liet Kynes's laboratory.
Yep. Okay.
They escape that afternoon, fly up into the storm.
Yeah, the Coriolis storm.
Coriolis storm. Land back down in the deep desert.
Are we to believe that they spent a number of hours in the storm kind of being jostled around?
A while, at least. I mean, we don't really know because Paul's also not conscious for this.
It looks like they slept, though, for like however they managed to do that. It looks like they got some shut-eye.
I don't think they have.
Oh, okay.
Because they crash that afternoon,
mm-hmm.
and they immediately have to, you know, get into still suits. And
right. Paul watches his mom change clothes. Yep, I remember this.
That really... Oh God. And then they're walking through the desert. It mm-hmm. becomes nighttime where Paul finds the drum sand and
right.
just fucking stomps on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then
rookie move.
They're fucking booking it across the open desert, make it to mm-hmm. the rock.
Okay. They so now at, we're at like 4 days.
No.
Oh, is this so. All in the? Okay,
this
so,
is all. This so is
from
all
the testing station to
from the morning that Duncan picked them up.
Okay,
to the night where they're looking at the pulsating butthole of Shai Hulud's mouth.
Yeah,
that's one day.
Woo, that's a heck of a day.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then overnight, they're just chilling in the rocks, and they discover that they're being watched by the Fremen. That next morning is Paul and Jameis's fight in the end of Dune Part One.
Gotcha. Okay. So by our estimate,
3 days.
3 days. They're on the morning of the fourth when they leave.
No, morning of the third when they leave. The night of the attack.
Mm-hmm.
Day in still tent.
Okay.
Nexus and storm and changing in front of mom.
Okay.
Fight with Jameis.
Got it. Okay. Cool, cool, cool.
Okay. It's been a rough couple of days for Paul.
Yeah. All right, cool. So this is sometime either during those 3 days or if we're continuing the, you know, if they're picking up where the story left off, we're seeing these piles of bodies were accumulated over the 3 days or organized, I guess, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
Over the 3 days. And this is where we are picking up in this story.
Yep.
Okay. I'm glad we spent time to go through that.
People are always like, how do you talk about a minute of a movie for like 20, 30 minutes? This is how.
We find ways.
Life finds a way.
So Princess Urulan.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Says something, by morning, the Atreides were no more. All of them? I mean, yeah, I understand all of them on Arrakis, but like all of them? Were some of them not still on Caladan? Were there not other branches of the Atreides family?
I thought the whole thing was that Hasimir Fenring was given ownership of Caladan while the Atreides were on Arrakis. Like, I thought that was one of the big things with Fenring.
Oh, I can't remember. I need to read. I need to go through.
It and falls under his fiefdom.
Yeah, I feel like you're right. I can't say one way or the other right now. I don't know. It's just like, you know, it strains belief that there are no other Atreides branches of the family.
I think it's safe to say when she says the Atreides are no more, that's like the majority of them are fucking. And by majority, I mean like 97% of them are fucking cooked. Yeah. Literally, because flamethrowers.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So from these smoldering piles of bodies, we hard cut to a very nice looking place.
Yeah, luscious green garden.
Yeah, we get
very
some...
Very peaceful.
We get some light shining through the trees.
We love a sunbeam.
Reflecting off some fog or morning mist or whatever you want to call it. And it just looks like a very nice place to be.
Markedly not Arrakis.
Yes. The amount of smoldering piles of bodies that we're led to believe exist here.
Probably zero.
I would hazard to say upwards of zero. It means the same thing. It's just fun to say it that way.
Just threw me off guard for a second while I'm taking a drink.
Camera swings around and we see two people sitting in front of a board game. Both of them sporting some real, real nice slick back haircuts.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but if our listeners have not or have forgotten, I'm a bald man myself. Mm-hmm. I shave my head. I was so envious of these slick back hairdos that these folks are wearing. I had hair envy for a moment because they're impressive. I think you could pull it off.
My hair's too Spaceballs helmet-ish to do like a full slick back. Because like if I try and grow my hair out, right, like I have very thick hair, but very thick hair in the sense that like I have a lot of hair, but the individual strands are very thin. So like they don't keep shape well.
I got a glue stick in the car. We could solve this problem.
Get a fucking big ass bottle of like the heaviest of hair gels. Yeah.
Heck probably. Yeah.
My hair is also not long enough to do that.
How about this? How about over the course of this movie, our coverage of this movie, you grow your hair out and see if we can attempt to slick back.
I got to go to a wedding in like a couple weeks. I'm getting a haircut.
All right, fine.
Yeah.
Coward.
I want to look good for a friend's wedding. I'm sorry.
Are you saying the slick backs don't look good?
My hair's not long enough to do a slick back right now, Zach.
All right, anyways.
My hair's long enough to get in my fucking eyes, and that's about it.
Who are these two people that we are talking about? We get to see one of them in focus. One of them is slightly out of focus with the back turned to us. The one that we get to see in focus is your boy, Christopher Walken.
Christopher motherfucking Walken.
Old Chris looking contemplative as fuck right
Walk
now.
Without rhythm. Can't attract the worm.
Exactly. So this is our first glance into, or first viewing of Shaddam Carino IV.
Yeah.
The Emperor, even. The Padishah Emperor, even. Of the Carino Empire.
Atop the Golden Lion throne himself.
That's exactly where he sits.
We got a name drop for him in part one.
It's true.
Very early on. Good old Harold. but we see him in the flesh this time.
That's right. So a little bit about Shaddam Carino IV, John.
Yes, go for it.
So Shaddam is the 81st Padishah Emperor of the Carino Empire. He was born on the planet Khitan in the year 10119. And he ascended to the throne in the year 10156 after his father was poisoned.
Unfortunate.
Yes. Not really, I would say, because it was actually Shaddam's plan to have him poisoned. So,
well, I mean, it's still unfortunate for him.
Yes, unfortunate for the father, but this allowed...
No one wants to be poisoned.
I'm sure there are some. Shaddam is the father of five daughters, so my heart goes out to him, from his wife, Anarul. Now, does that name sound familiar?
Not at all.
Oh, okay. Well, let me learn you something, John. Anarul was named after a character that we met in Dune Prophecy, Mother Rakella. She had like 15 names, so I can't remember all of them, but Anarul was one of the names.
Yes.
So having five daughters, with his wife Anarul, who was a Bene Gesserit, so you know, as most imperial children come into this world, their mother
would say all of them.
Yeah, mother was a Bene Gesserit. Having no legitimate sons, this really ensured that Shaddam would be the last emperor from House Carino, or at least to carry on the Carino name. Outside of the Dune universe, Shaddam Carino IV has been played by some heavy hitters of actors over the years. So Jose Ferrer in David Lynch's 1984 movie.
Rest in peace.
Giancarlo Giannini in the sci-fi miniseries.
Fantastic miniseries.
Absolutely.
If you love Dune but haven't seen that, you can buy a Blu-ray of it on Amazon. Go do it. It's great.
And of course, Christopher Walken in the Denis Villeneuve films. So I'm excited to get to know the Christopher Walken version of the Emperor as we go throughout this movie. So like I said a little bit ago, he is looking stressed right now, not paying attention to this game that he and his daughter are playing.
He's getting his ass beat, by the way, because Irulan is like tapping the board and taking his pieces. Like,
it looks like
absolute disrespect.
It looked like a mix of like, what's that? That I'm going to call it Chinese checkers, and that's probably not the right word for it.
I know the exact game.
Okay, please go.
So, as is tradition, Art and Soul of Dune, part two.
Ooh, we get to open up part two.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Has a lot to say, not only about Christopher Walken, but about this game. So far as the Christopher Walken casting and everything is concerned, the book says that they really wanted a character that would show the vulnerability and humanity of someone who is losing power and has to bear the guilt of betraying one of his most beloved subjects.
Right. And the book goes into detail about how the Emperor thought of Leto Atreides as his son.
Sure. And I mean, even Irulan here in this minute talks about how, you know, Shaddam really did love Leto.
Yep.
We'll get more into Shaddam's motivations for all of this a little later on when it's relevant in the movie. But yeah, no, this wasn't a light decision that he made, but one that he did ultimately make. But let's go back to chess. This is Cheops chess.
Cheops chess. Will you spell that for me?
C-H-E-O-P-S.
Okay.
I'm probably missing the pronunciation.
Your guess is as good as mine, because that doesn't exist here in the real world, does it?
No, but it exists in the Dune Encyclopedia. So, Cheops chess, or pyramid chess, and I'm just going to read directly from the encyclopedia here, is a game which has evolved from what they like to call little chess, which employed a 64 squared monoplane board.
Okay.
Which is, as you know, the standard chessboard that we have today, the 8x8 grid.
Yeah, I could do math, yeah.
Sure.
Who says I can't?
Well, you know, you did grow up in rural Georgia, so.
Yeah, fair. Okay.
Art and Soul of Dune shows us the Cheops chessboard, which is comprised of a lot of not only horizontal and vertical lines, but a lot of diagonal lines for movement as well.
Okay, this seems confusing to me.
Yeah, it's not quite 4D chess in the way that you imagine it, with like multiple, you know, boards stacked on top of each other.
Yeah, not Star Trek 4D chess.
Yeah, but you're definitely moving across, you know, not only straight lines left and right, but those diagonal planes. But then you also have diamonds within this square field as well.
Okay.
For this chessboard. So
interesting.
Unfortunately, the encyclopedia doesn't really go into the mechanics of the game. It actually goes more into the history of like well-known Cheops chess players.
Oh, okay. That seems, yeah.
All before Paul's time. Yeah, no, it's really like, it doesn't really give us much information about it, but we do know that there are diamond pieces and circular pieces.
Okay.
And Art and Soul shows us the diamond pieces are black, the circular pieces are white, and there are pieces that vary in size from like super small, almost like the size of your pinky nail,
okay,
to up to like the size of the whole tip of your thumb.
Okay.
Which I would assume is just their various like pawn to king structure or whatever.
Gotcha.
But yeah, this game is called Cheops Chess, and it's an evolution of Little Chess for a more refined mind. The encyclopedia calls Little Chess essentially a game for simple minds that is really limited only to the children of old Earth.
Gotcha.
So basically, so, modern chess is for stupid people, according to the Dune Encyclopedia.
And Cheops chess is an elegant game for a more sophisticated time.
Exactly.
All right, cool. Well, thank you for that. Yeah. We get to learn it. And you know what? I hope that someone makes a replica of this board to sell, because I would love to have one on my coffee
table. Just to have, so people are like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, and I go, oh, you only play little chess? Okay. All right, well. Sorry, I didn't know I was inviting stupids to my house.
Well, Art and Soul actually has a very detailed picture of a Cheops chessboard, so we know someone that does a lot of woodwork. We could probably convince them to try and make a Cheops chessboard for us.
That'd be pretty cool. So we get a line from the princess here after we kind of get the close-up on Christopher Walken's face, the Emperor. It's going to be really hard for me to call him the Emperor and not just Christopher Walken throughout us doing this.
Wow.
There it is. Took 20 minutes for us to do the first Christopher Walken impression.
That's the last one for a while.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm sure they'll come up. The princess says, and the Emperor said nothing. So really just filling us, the audience, in on his just like approval or inaction on the betrayal of House Atreides. So everything that the princess is saying up until this point is really just giving us backstory on what happened in the first movie. As we transition into the second movie, setting the stage, giving us the Cliff Notes version of part one.
Well, it's also giving us the backstory of what's happening on Kytane rather than just what we've seen on Arrakis.
Yeah, right, right. So at this point, we get our first good look at Princess Irulan. So let's talk a little bit about her. I mentioned earlier that the Emperor had five daughters.
Yep.
She is the eldest of these five daughters. Did you notice anything interesting about the way her name is spelled?
There's no I before the U.
Well, yeah, separate from I have a hard time pronouncing it. Yes.
Irulan. No.
It is an anagram of Anarul.
No, it's not.
Bum.
Yes, it is. Fuck.
So her name is, in a sense, she was named after her mother, who was named after Raquella, the first mother superior of the Bene Gesserit. The princess has been trained in the Bene Gesserit ways, but it was noted that she was only an average student. So she did not have any kind of special affinity for Bene Gesserit ways. Real just, you know, center of the road Bene Gesserit student.
Some fucking weak shit.
They cited the problem with her not really excelling in Bene Gesserit studies as she retained her strong sense of personal identity and ambition, which are typically non-desirable traits in an organization like the Bene Gesserit.
Fair, but also if you are the daughter of the Emperor, you're going to have a sense of personal identity and ambition. So.
Sure. And this actually caused some tension with her and her father, who is the exact same way. Princess Irulan is a prolific author. Part of what I'm going to be doing this season is quoting a lot more of the excerpts from the book.
Sure.
So each chapter of the book is open, or I would say not each, but most of the chapters in the book are preceded by a quote from the princess from one of her books. And it's usually relevant to what is happening in the chapter. If you want a deeper dive into the quotes of Princess Irulan, I highly implore you to go check out Dune Navigator's deep dive into this topic, because he compiled all of the quotes either before the chapters or spoken in the book by the princess. And really, it paints a good picture of just her studies and how she exists in this world. So it's a very, very good, comprehensive study on the princess.
Shout out to friend of the show, Dune Navigator.
Yeah, absolutely. I picked out a passage from the book that I wanted to, you know, use right now as an example, but also just to illustrate the kind of passages that we get before each chapter. The quote is, "The Fremen were supreme in that quality that the ancients called Spanisbogen." And that is Spanungsbogen, a German word.
Okay.
Continuing the quote, "which is the self-imposed delay between desire for a thing and the act of reaching out to grasp that thing." And that is from the princess's book, Wisdom of Muad'Dib. So, what I took from that is that the Fremen are canonical edgers. They...
That is not where I was expecting you to go with this. They're just fucking edging constantly.
It is the self-imposed delay between desire for a thing and the act of reaching out to grasp that thing.
Oh my God.
That is a direct quote from the book, John. Oh, calls them like a season, right?
Oh man, you got jokes today. It wouldn't be the Dune Minute without him.
Sorry, it's not a good show, folks. So the Bene Gesserit wanted to exploit the princess at some point, not necessarily for her being her, but really just for the fact that she was the emperor's daughter. They really just viewed her as a piece on their fancy chessboard.
The Cheops chessboard.
Thank you. I couldn't remember the name. Out of universe, she's been portrayed by a number of, again, heavy-hitting actresses. In the 1984 David Lynch Dune, she was portrayed by Virginia Madsen for about 10 minutes.
Right at the start of the movie,
yeah.
Too.
Right at the start.
She pops in, and she's immediately dismissed.
That's right.
We see her give exposition for...
About 40 minutes before the movie starts.
Not 40, but...
I know.
Yeah. She lays the groundwork for all the major planets and yep. You know, stuff like that, but...
So that's Virginia Madsen. In the sci-fi miniseries, Julie Cox took up the mantle to play the princess. And, of course, in the Denis Villeneuve films, we are graced with the presence of Florence Pugh, who I think knows, or spoiler alert, does a great job.
Yeah, she does a fantastic job. And so I don't remember where I read this or maybe saw it from. I think it was an interview with Denis where he was basically saying the way that he got her into this movie was very similar to the way that he was able to get Zendaya into Dune Part 1, where it was, hey, you're a minor character in this movie, but then later on you will be very important. Spoilers for Messiah, Irulan is very important. So I can only look forward to what we will see with her in Denis' adaptation of Dune Messiah. Very excited for that. But I can't say anything more than she will be more important than she is in this movie. And if it's anything like her performance in this movie, I think she's going to do great.
Yep, agreed. So continuing with the movie, we still get the voiceover from the princess. His inaction is difficult for me to accept. Well, this is not technically voiceover because we see her saying these words.
Sure. Before we dive in on the rest of this minute, I want to talk about this garden a little bit because... Sure. What we just saw with the Cheops chess scene and what we're about to talk about are technically on the same planet in universe, but shot in two very different locations. So Art and Soul of Dune giving us a lot of insight into the production of Dune Part 2 and a lot of behind the scenes stuff. This garden scene was shot in Budapest, which, as you know, Dune Part 1 was heavily shot in Budapest.
Mm-hmm.
This was shot in the Japanese garden at the Varga Martin Museum.
I love a Japanese garden. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
There was something, the Art and Soul talks about, there was something about this one tree in that garden that just like everyone on the production team was like, absolutely, like this is, we need to shoot something here. And I think it's a great, you know, first like opening scene to see, you know, just what Kaitain is all about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we haven't been ever since we left Arrakis.
We've stayed on Arrakis.
Yeah.
Well, other than a quick jaunt to Gaty Prime.
A quick jaunt to Gaty Prime and some prescient visions looking forward at other planets.
And Seleucus Secundus and whatnot.
Yeah. I think there was a shot of Caladan or something that we...
Nope.
Oh,
yeah. Yes, yes.
Something that when we had Paul presumed.
Was tripping balls.
Yeah.
In the tent. Episode 100.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Because I remember that because the thumbnail
had the party hats.
Were the soldiers with the party hats and the confetti and everything.
That's right. That's
that
right.
was a fun thumbnail to make.
So, back in the movie, we get a voiceover continuing. Well, not really a voiceover. We get to see her talking. Into, I guess, like some kind of handheld recorder.
It is.
And she's in what looks like a study. She's sitting in front of a desk. You know, now that we've spent so much time in Dune Prophecy,
mm-hmm.
And we're kind of like out of order a little bit. Dune Part 2 came out, you know, almost a full year before Dune Prophecy did.
About 9 months.
Yeah, okay, well,
came out in March.
The better part of
came
the
out
year.
In March of last year. Prophecy was November.
Yeah, the better part of a year before Dune Prophecy. I love how the design for the Imperial palaces was fairly consistent, or at least from the architecture that we see in this study.
Yeah.
It seems like there was a through line of continuity from the movie to the show with how the palace on Seleucus Secundus in Prophecy was designed, like the set decoration and design. So I appreciate that. I noticed it, and I was like, that's really nice. Very cool.
So you're talking about this little recorder that she's talking into.
Mm-hmm.
What she's actually speaking into is a microphone, which is connected to a Shiga wire spool.
Yeah, yeah.
And the, of course, Art and Soul talks quite a bit about the creation of this Shiga wire spool and its design process and everything. But basically, Denis wanted something that was still very analog because we are living in a world without thinking machines,
mm-hmm.
But still futuristic. So having Shiga wire as an option to then essentially recreate like those wax phonograph
sure.
spools, if you've ever seen those.
Mm-hmm.
But it's Shiga wire with what, and we'll see this in more detail later on, but with what are like little almost tattoo gun needles carving mm-hmm. into, this metal spool everything that she's saying.
Right. Okay.
It's really cool.
Very nice. Very cool. Technology is apparently cyclical. So right from here, we cut to a burning portrait of Leto.
Yep.
Where she continues, the Emperor loved Duke Leto Atreides like a son.
Yeah, he's willing to just kill
yep.
him.
Yep. And from this burning portrait, which is a very nice portrait, by the way, it looks very good.
Oscar Isaac's a beautiful man.
Yeah, he sure is easy on the eyes. We cut over to Rabban, or Rabban, as you like to say. Surrounded by other hearkening goons. The goons are back, John.
The goons are back. We got fucking Fremen edgers and hearkening goons.
They are all done up in their formal black goon attire. And they seem to be at some kind of ribbon ceremony because there is a looming figure that places a ribbon around Rabban's neck.
It's a more of a giant metallic medallion.
Yeah. Oh, that is the word I was looking for last night when I was doing these notes. And then the voiceover continues, but my father's...
And that's the end of our minute.
And that's the end of our minute. We were blessed last movie with a lot of dialogue that just ended at the minute cut.
So not here. Not here, baby. We're cutting in the middle of sentences. We're cutting in the middle of words. But you know what? This is the Dune minute, not the Dune minute in 1 second. That's so.
True. That is true. We stick by our core ethos.
Yeah.
So that's where, yeah, exactly. That is where our minute ends. And we will get to see who exactly this looming figure is tomorrow. and see a little bit more into this, you know, I guess exposition minute or exposition block that the princess has given us.
Sure. Real quick before we go, I want to talk about the second location where this opening sequence is shot.
Okay.
Because the scene that we have here where Irulan is speaking into the microphone connected to the Shiga wire recorder is actually the first scene of Dune Part 2 that was shot in at all.
Oh, cool.
It was shot in the summer of 2022 at the Brion Sanctuary in the village of Asolo, which is about an hour's drive away from Venice in Italy.
Ooh,
the cool. Brion Sanctuary is actually a... family plot like burial ground for this family, the Brion family. It was commissioned in 1969 by the wife of the founder of the Brion Vega company, which made, if you Google the Brion Vega company and like what they made in the 60s and 70s, these super like retro futuristic looking TVs and radio sets and everything like that. Like when you think of like retrofuturism from the 50s, this is the kind of shit that they made. Really cool looking stuff.
Looks like it's still a company.
Yeah, no, it still definitely exists because the son of the founder, who is important within the company, was a huge fan of Dune and a huge fan of Dune Part 1 by Denis Villeneuve, that he granted the first license to film at this location because of his love of Dune. A lot of other places had requested filming and they had always denied before. But these, and we'll see a lot more of this later on, and I'll have a lot more to talk about with like the architecture and everything when we see other scenes from this spot. But all of these like big fancy rooms and everything are all a part of this sanctuary spot in this family plot of land.
That's really cool. You know, I, as you were talking, I pulled up their website. I love this stuff.
Yeah.
It is very pricey.
Yeah. Oh, but it is not cheap. And if you look up pictures of the sanctuary, you will understand where the money goes.
That is a absolutely beautiful turntable unit, I guess. It's like speakers and amplifier and turntable all in one. That is gorgeous.
Yeah, so the Brion Sanctuary, we'll have a lot more to talk about it later on. I know this is an episode that's running a little long, but hey, you know, we're here.
All right, cool, man. Well, anything else for this minute?
I don't have anything else for now. I know we've got some more minutes to get to recording, so let's head on out, unless there's anything you've got.
Nothing from me.
Cool. As always, you can find us online. We are on Blue Sky at DuneMinute.com. You can also find us on YouTube. All of the podcast episodes are on YouTube as well. You can just search the Dune Minute and you'll find our channel there. And you can email DuneMinute@gmail.com if you'd like to get in touch with us. We'll be back tomorrow with another episode of the Dune Minute.
All right. See you then.
See you.